Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. When I learned of an opportunity to talk with John Meacham, author of Soul of America and books about Jefferson, Jackson, Roosevelt, and Churchill, when we got word that he would be available to talk about his latest, a book on Abraham Lincoln, the first thought that came to mind was maybe this world-renowned chronicler of history can help us gain some perspective on what's happening now, these times. And then the book, titled And There Was Light, arrived in the mail, and that hope has been rewarded. Joining us as he prepares for an appearance at the Kentucky Book Festival on October 29th is John Meacham. We thank you for spending some time with us, Dr. Meacham.
Honored to be here. Thank you.
So I'm going to begin this by jumping all the way to the back of the book, where in the acknowledgments, you cite Bram Stoker remarking to Walt Whitman that no one in the future can ever know Abraham Lincoln. He was much greater, so much vaster than even his surroundings. So many have tried to know Abe Lincoln. What motivated you to create this new narrative on his life and death?
Well, you know, Frederick Douglass said, "I do not despair of this country. The fiat of the Almighty, let there be light, has not yet spent its force." And that's a statement of hope amid gloom. When you imagine Douglass said that in an age of human enslavement that would give way to the long, painful decades of segregation. But there can be light. And it comes when brave people do the right thing, which sounds like a needlepoint pillow or a coffee mug, but it has the virtue of being true. And Abraham Lincoln, for all of his faults, for all of his manifold sins and wickednesses, as the old Episcopal prayer book would say, was in fact a figure who was driven not only by politics, but by conscience. At several moments when political reality would have led a political man to do the opposite of what he did, Lincoln insisted that the experiment in American democracy, devoted to the principles of the Declaration of Independence, must go on. His advisors wanted him to take a deal between his election in 1860 and his inauguration. There was a perfectly politically rational deal proposed by a senator from Kentucky, Crittenden, and Lincoln said, "No, I'm not going to give in and allow slavery to move westward." That took guts. He went in, and the first problem presented to him when he walked into his office on the second floor of the White House was whether to reinforce Fort Sumter with South Carolinians who had succeeded the previous December threatening a federal fort. And the commanding general of the U.S. Army and his own Secretary of State said, "Don't do it. This isn't the place for the fight." And Lincoln said, "No, the right to succeed, the right to break up the Union, is not inherent in the American experiment." And then in 1864, when he faced a reelection campaign that he was losing, in fact, he wrote a memo saying, "It is likely that this administration will be defeated. And if so, I will accept the result and work with the president-elect." That sounds interesting, doesn't it, in our current climate? He would not give up emancipation. The chairman of the Republican National Committee came to him and said, "Give up emancipation as a precondition for peace, and you will win." And Lincoln said no. And so what I wanted to figure out is, often we see Lincoln as either this monumental figure, or there's a historical view that he was just a politician. He was somewhere between the two, and he wasn't perfect, but he left us a more perfect union. And I think that that should be not alienating, that is, we shouldn't see him as this distant hero, but it should be inspiring to us. Because if a flawed, fallen, and fallible man in that era could do it, then we can too.
How did Lincoln's thoughts about slavery and the status of African Americans evolve and change over the course of the Civil War?
Well, his views on slavery were very much shaped by the three states in which he lived as a young man, right? He was born in Kentucky, as you know, lived in Indiana, ended up in Illinois. I believe that when Lincoln said, "I am naturally anti-slavery, I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel," Lincoln was a lawyer and a great writer, and he chose his words with care. And the word "naturally" there is really important because it's basically a synonym for from birth. It's like nativity. And I ground the rescue of the American experience from human enslavement in some Baptist communities in your state. Thomas Lincoln and both his wives were members of Baptist denominations that were anti-slavery. They were called emancipation churches. Think about that for a second. What are the odds that the man who would become the president of the United States in 1861 would be the child of a house that subscribed to anti-slavery theology in Kentucky in the first part of the 19th century? How many anti-slavery Baptists could there have been in Kentucky in those years? And yet, blessedly, providentially, that was the case. There were economic reasons. Thomas Lincoln was a small Boer farmer. White farmers didn't like slavery because it meant that landowning aristocrats could afford enslaved labor, thereby suppressing them. So it was not entirely moral, but there was a moral component to it. And as Lincoln went through his rise in politics in Illinois, he was anti-slavery. He was not a racial egalitarian. We should not make him Martin Luther King in a stovepipe hat. He was not that. But neither should he be mindlessly condemned. He believed that the Declaration of Independence applied not only to white people, but to black people. And that was not a majority position in the United States heading into the 1860s. Stephen Douglas disagreed, and Stephen Douglas beat him, right? Twice, 1854 and 1858. And that part of the thing that just fascinates me about him, and what's so wonderful to be in the papers and read the newspapers of the time and his letters and speeches, is this was not a political winner. Right. Being anti-slavery was not a path to power in Illinois in the 1850s. If it had been, he would have been Senator Lincoln. But he wasn't. And yet he stuck to it. Why did he stick to it? Because he believed, as he put it at Cooper Union, that slavery is wrong.
Well, you mentioned Douglas, and you capture such granular details in the book, such as the manner of Lincoln's posture and even the way he held and motioned with his hands during that first debate with Stephen Douglas. Is it the intent of including such fine details to kind of humanize not only historical figures, but the events themselves and the times?
Absolutely. I think history is fundamentally a story. And particularly given the divisions that confront us today, I believe we have a certain moral obligation to understand as best we can, not only the crises that were faced in the past, but obviously how we overcame them. And they didn't just disappear. This was not like Brigadoon, right? You know, a land didn't just arrive and everything was fine. These were human beings. Abraham Lincoln was a human being. He had good days and bad days. He had a difficult marriage. He lost two children. He could say things that we find repugnant now. Yet, he transcended the limitations of his time and place to put us on a better path. Many people in real time thought he'd gone too far. many people in real time didn't think he went far enough. But if we don't understand the air they breathed, the forces that shaped them, the range of options that were actually available, if we can't put ourselves back in their shoes, then I think they risk becoming mythic. And if they're mythic, they lose some of their capacity to teach, because studying heroes can be interesting, but it's a little alienating, right? It creates a certain distance, mm-hmm. as if that they were all on Olympus and we're in the valley. The point is, we're all in the valley, and the goal is to get to higher ground.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a bookmark at page 214 in the book, and on that page you tell us about an event with an eerie parallel. You touched on this earlier, to the January 6th, 2021 assault on the Capitol in Washington, and that was the certification of the 1860 election of Lincoln as president. And as was the case on January 6th, it all came down to the vice president, who at the time, in 1861, was a Kentuckian. Tell us about that.
John C. Breckinridge, Vice President of the United States, had lost to Lincoln the previous year. He did his duty. He was under immense pressure not to certify the Electoral College votes. Lincoln saw this. There were threats of assassination pouring into Illinois. As we know, there was a plot in Baltimore. Lincoln had to slip into the city. Frederick Douglass said, in that sense, Lincoln was like a fugitive slave. He was trying to escape through the night to freedom. Breckinridge did his duty. He had sworn an oath to the Constitution. He, as you know, became a Confederate officer, became a Confederate official. Mm-hmm. But because he was the vice president of a nation that had certain rules, he insisted on fulfilling his duty, not unlike Mike Pence. And had he not done that, in the same way, we don't know what would have happened if Vice President Pence had caved to the pressure, the immense pressure he was under, perhaps the entire experiment falls apart. There was the sense that a Southern army was going to come. They were going to sack the archives. They were going to seize the Capitol. They were going to install Jefferson Davis, possibly as president. These things were adjudicated. They were investigated by a House committee. So this isn't some kind of retroactive analogy shopping. This, it's all in the record. And John Breckinridge, his loyalty to the Constitution to which he had sworn an oath, he would break that oath, but not that day. And Winfield Scott, the commanding general who secured the Capitol, said he was going to shoot anyone who tried to storm the Capitol out a window. He was ready for a fight, and plainclothes policemen from Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore were stationed in the Capitol to secure the box of electoral votes when they went from the Senate across to the House, just as they do today. And so it was, as Wellington said of Waterloo, the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life. But the character of Breckinridge mattered.
Well, we're living now in a time when perspective is certainly at a premium. It's certainly not the first time the country has experienced deep political turmoil. But in the past, these past times of upheaval, the basic dynamics of American democracy held firm. As an historian, do you sense that this time, this period, is different?
I think we're as close to chaos as we have been since Lincoln came to office. And that's because there is an implacable minority of Americans who have a differing understanding of reality and law and custom than the majority of Americans do. In 1860-61, that led to armed conflict. I pray that that does not happen. I don't think we're at risk of a civil war, but I think self-evidently we are experiencing and will continue to experience civil chaos in a way that we did not, for instance, in the 1930s. we did to some extent in the 1960s with white supremacist, anti-integration violence. Mm-hmm. But people weren't questioning elections then, right? They weren't fundamentally questioning the constitutional order. And what Lincoln teaches us is that in the give and take of a constitutional democracy, in the manufacturing of consensus, guess what? You have to give as well as take. And he clearly saw the Civil War, the struggle over the Union, as a battle for human liberty against slavery. He also saw it as a global test of whether popular government could long endure. And if democracy failed here, he believed it would not succeed anywhere else. It's when he called it the last best hope, when he said, we cannot escape history, that what we do now will light us down unto the last generation. And I believe that's true today. If American democracy fails, it is a fatal blow to the forces of liberty under law around the world. And if you doubt me, I refer you to Vladimir Putin, and I refer you to the Chinese Communist Party and the perennial appetites and ambitions of autocrats around the world. The rule of the strong is nature's default position. What is so remarkable about the United States of America in administrations of Republicans and Whigs and Democrats for 240 years now is that the strong are restrained by law in order to give the weak an equal standing before that law. And it's based on a sense of neighborliness. I don't mean to sound like Mr. Rogers here. There was actually a wonderful tweet some months ago that said, if Doris Kearns Goodwin and Mr. Rogers had had a love child, I would have been the result. But it is based on seeing each other as neighbors, because I extend my hand to my neighbor when he needs help in the morning, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because I might need his hand in the afternoon. That's what democracy is, and that's what Lincoln was defending.
At the book festival on the 29th, we will hear you in conversation with historian David Blight, author of Frederick Douglass, who referred to, Prophet of Freedom, winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize in History, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. Are there important points where your works on Lincoln and his works on Douglass intersect?
Absolutely. They were vital to each other. And David is a marvelous friend and historian, and has forgotten more about most of these things than I know. So I hope he goes easy on me. But absolutely, Douglass was arguably the greatest orator of the 19th century, and possibly in American history. And he articulated a vision of the country in which, as he put it, if white Americans will live up to the promise that they made for themselves, that we are all created equal, then America's worth defending. Douglass was not about, all in all, was not about destroying the Constitution, was not about starting all over again, which some abolitionists were. William Lloyd Garrison burned a copy of the Constitution on the 4th of July, 1854, and said it was a pact with the devil and an agreement with death. And Douglass said no, that in fact, it had the seeds of justice, which is what Dr. King's argument ultimately became, right? The March on Washington speech is not about a radical transformation of America. It's about a radical embrace of America. And Douglass articulated that. And in many ways, it fell to Lincoln to bring it about at the highest levels of white power. And so they were in conversation, both literally and figuratively. And ultimately, Douglass would say that Lincoln was in fact the black man's president. He later said that he was preeminently the white man's president, but that the liberation of the black American populace was in the hands of this man, and that man did the right thing.
That's historian, author John Meacham. We thank you so much for this delightful conversation. We'll see you in Lexington on the 29th.
Look forward to it.
Also appearing at the Kentucky Book Festival this year is the author of a novel that resonates on several levels among many in the bluegrass, and she is the guest of our Kentucky Authors Series contributor, Tom Eblin.
Geraldine Brooks is an award-winning journalist and writer originally from Australia. She is the author of 6 novels and 3 nonfiction books. Her novel March won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Her latest novel is partially set in central Kentucky. Titled simply Horse, the book is about the greatest thoroughbred racehorse and sire of the 19th century, Lexington. The book is a compelling piece of historical fiction, but it's not just a horse story. In the book's afterword, she wrote this, "As I began researching Lexington's life, it became clear to me that this novel could not merely be about a racehorse. It would also need to be about race. And it is, from antebellum slavery to modern racism in America." Geraldine Brooks will be reading from the book and signing it on October 29th at this year's Kentucky Book Festival at Joseph Beth Booksellers. We're pleased to have her with us here today. Geraldine Brooks, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Well, it's wonderful to be there.
Well, tell us a little about the story of this novel.
Well, I became horse crazy rather late in life. Sensible people become horse obsessed at 5 or 15, but I was in my 50s. And it came to the point where I had a horse and all I wanted to do was think about her and how to be a better rider. And I wasn't getting any actual work done on the book I was supposed to be writing. But then I had a great stroke of luck at a lunch completely by chance. I met the official from the Smithsonian who had just delivered Lexington's skeleton to the International Museum of the Horse. And as he was regaling us with details of the horse's magnificent career and then the danger and risk that the horse was in during the Civil War, my lunch was uneaten and I just couldn't wait to get home and research more and start writing about Lexington.
Well, a number of your characters are historical figures, you know, Cassius Clay and Mary Barr Clay and the owners of Lexington. How did you choose and research them?
Well, it's pretty easy to research characters like Cassius Clay because he owned a newspaper, The True American, and he was such a notorious celebrity in his own day. And then, you know, Alicia Warfield, on whose farm Lexington was foaled, also had a high profile because he was a famous doctor as well as being a great thoroughbred owner. And he had actually delivered Mary Todd Lincoln. So there was plenty about those people and plenty about the horse's racing career because there were so many newspapers just dedicated to covering the turf in that day. It was such a national obsession. What was a lot harder was trying to research the lives of the gifted, talented black horse experts who were responsible for the day-to-day care of Lexington and his early success as trainers and jockeys, and very, very hard to get detail about their life because, of course, they were mostly enslaved or formerly enslaved, and their labor was not being remunerated. Their labor was being plundered to create the wealth and prestige of the turf in that day.
Well, tell us about your character, Jared, who's in the book is Lexington's groom and later trainer.
Well, yeah, so I wanted to write about a relationship between humans and horses. And I know from experience, being around a lot of barns, that the step that the horse recognizes is the person who's responsible for the day-to-day care, the person who feeds and brushes and tends to the hurts and maybe even sleeps in the stable sometimes, and that would have been the groom. So I knew that Lexington had a black groom called Jarrett because there is a painting of Lexington in later life being led out by Black Jarrett, his groom. And when I went to find out who that Jarrett had been, there was very, very short rations to be found about him, just, you know, some payment records after the Emancipation Proclamation and some indirect references in letters between Lexington's various owners. So I just took all my feelings about horses and my experience in caring for my own horse and gave those experiences to Jarrett. And then for the rest, I relied on the work of real historians of that period who have done such detailed work on unearthing the lives of the enslaved.
Well, the novel also includes a parallel storyline, a modern storyline that's built around paintings of Lexington. Tell us a little about that and how you came to create those characters.
Well, the interesting thing about this novel is that anything that seems very unlikely in it is the thing that is true. And the more mundane things are the things I made up.
Yeah.
This plot point and storyline is based on the fact that a Kentucky plant manager from the University of Kentucky unearthed a painting by Thomas Scott that had been thrown out in his neighbor's trash. And from that painting, he discovered the incredible story of Thomas Scott, who's a fascinating character in his own right, and also painted Lexington many, many times during the horse's celebrated career. So I wanted to write about the paintings and their mysterious provenance and the journey that they had taken from the 1850s right through to New York in the 1950s through to the present day. And once I started writing something set in the present time, I thought I can't leave the story of race as if it's something that was over and done with in the 19th century, because we all know that's not true. Mm-hmm. And it had to echo in the contemporary story as well. And
that leads us to the characters of Theo and Jess. Tell us a little about them.
So Theo is an art historian. He's getting his PhD at Georgetown, and he is a Nigerian-American. And he is trying to research the lost histories of many of the black horsemen who are depicted with Lexington and other great thoroughbreds of the day in these wonderful paintings. And that research leads him to encounter a Smithsonian scientist, Jess. And she was the one character that I allowed myself a little holiday with, because she's very much based on my own experience as an Australian who came to America to study and ended up getting a fantastic job here.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope people will take away from this novel?
So I would never be arrogant enough to tell people what they should take away from a novel, because I think you take what you need to find, and what you find will be different. Even if you read it in your teens and then you read it again in your 20s, what you find will be quite different. That's been my experience. But, you know, I think, of course, Kentuckians know Lexington's story and are very proud of him and his incredible speed and endurance, but many, many people don't. So that was a great gift as a novelist, to find a great racehorse with a fantastic story that so many people didn't know.
Yeah, it's really amazing how popular horse racing was in the 19th century, and I don't think a lot of people now realize that, but these were the star athletes of their day.
It was huge. It was, the only thing I can think of is, it was like the NFL if we all had pads and helmets in our closet and went out and played football. Because, of course, it was a very agrarian society there. Horses were in people's lives. If you didn't have a horse, you were only one generation away from having a horse. And the thoroughbred races, the entrepreneurs who ran them were just great showmen who could whip up a fascination with a great rivalry. So with Lexington, it was the rivalry with LeCompte, who had the same sire. And the owners had a lot of tension between them, so that made the races particularly exciting. And thousands of people would turn out, you know, 30,000, 40,000 people to the track And others followed it in the three newspapers that were entirely devoted to covering thoroughbred racing.
Well, it's a really terrific book, and it's a great education in history, but also a great look at race relations and issues in modern America. Once again, the book is titled Horse by Geraldine Brooks. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
For Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
You can find more information about the Kentucky Book Festival online at kybookfestival.org. The festival is produced by Kentucky Humanities, a WEKU sponsor. Coming up after the break, so you're thinking about writing a book. Tom Eblin mentioned the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, where you can get help with that. And we'll hear from the center's new director, Shayla Lynch, not only about services for budding writers, but support for those who have already published.
We are definitely very abundantly blessed when it comes to literary artists and writers in our state. And I want to help spread the word about that around the nation.
Melinda Jameson has written a children's book for her fellow court-appointed special advocates.
So this is one tool that a CASA volunteer can take when they're meeting a child or children for the first time to explain what their role is as a CASA volunteer.
And the latest in our series in partnership with CivicLex on the jobs of those local offices that will appear on the November 8th ballot. This week, the county attorney. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power and energy usage information to co-op members. Co-ops offer an online energy assessment to help evaluate energy usage. More information at your local co-op's virtual energy assessment link. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Shayla Lynch is the new executive director at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in Lexington. She succeeds longtime director Neil Chethick, who recently retired, to lead a mission to equip people to explore and express their voices through imaginative learning and the literary arts. And there are big plans for this fall. Shayla's here to tell us about that, as well as her take on the Kentucky literary community. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Shayla.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You've had a little time now to kind of settle in and take stock of things and think about a direction. So tell us about your plans for the Carnegie Center.
My plans are just to continue and fully support all of the phenomenal programming that we've done over the years and to continue to foster an inclusive space for all of our literary artists in our state and around our community, especially making sure that communities of color here in Lexington and the surrounding counties know about the Carnegie Center, know about the Kentucky Black Writers Collaborative, and feel welcomed within our walls and our doors and in our classes. So my goal is to continue to extend our reach to every corner, nook, and cranny of the state of Kentucky.
Sounds like Neil Chethick left you with a "if it ain't broke, don't fix it" situation.
he's a pretty hard act to follow. He did some phenomenal things at the center, so I'm humbled by the legacy that he's left us, and I just want to carry the baton forward.
All right. Well, I know that most of your professional experience has been in running social service nonprofits, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And you're also an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How will all that experience inform what you do at the Carnegie Center?
I have been blessed to be able to wear a lot of hats with my nonprofit experience. And that's kind of the beauty of working at a nonprofit. There's a lot of cross-training. And it's always an environment where everybody does a little bit of everything. So I've been able to learn HR and finance and do direct service for clients in need and do advocacy work on the state level, on the federal level, local level, you know. And so I'm going to use all of those skills that I've learned over the years working at nonprofits to continue to strengthen and elevate the Carnegie Center as well, because it is a very vibrant nonprofit and a mainstay in our community. And so I'm going to just use the wealth of knowledge I've gained in my years of nonprofit nonprofit service to continue to elevate the programs that we offer and the people that we reach.
Do you find it interesting, Shayla? I find this interesting, that a state that is so often portrayed as backward, we know all about that, but mm-hmm. that such a state has produced such a long list of great writers, not to mention the incoming U.S. Poet Laureate.
Right. We are definitely very abundantly blessed when it comes to literary artists and writers in our state. And I want to help spread the word about that around the nation, because we are very abundantly blessed. And as I've lived in Lexington for over 15 years, and I didn't even realize until I got to the Carnegie Center how blessed we are just in Lexington with some phenomenal writers. They're doing some amazing things and producing some amazing books and articles. And so I want to continue to bolster that so that everybody knows that we are a literary hub, that Lexington is a literary hub, Kentucky is a literary hub. And if you want to participate in some phenomenal artistic events and activities, Kentucky is the place to come to.
Well, let's say I've been thinking about writing a book. I've made that decision to write a book. That decision itself is pretty difficult.
Yeah.
But I have no idea how or where to start. Can I get help with that at the Carnegie Center?
You definitely can. All you have to do is send us an email, give us a call, or just come and stop by, and we will direct you to the programs that will help support your endeavor. We have mentoring that we offer authors that need the extra help, support, and push when it comes to producing their work. We have an Authors Academy that is a 9-month commitment to foster the writers and to foster what's the work they're trying to produce as well. And we have had many great authors come through that Author Academy, so much so that we have now an alumni group of the Author Academy that meet monthly to continue to provide support and to network to authors after they've been through the Author Academy as well. So we like to wrap our arms around all the authors that if they just have the idea, I think I want to write a book, or I think I want to write something, we'll hold your hand and guide you through that process, even to the steps to work with a literary agent and connect with them as well to take your book to the mainstream.
What other kind of programs are available for writers?
We have a wealth of classes. Actually, our fall class catalog was just released. So and you can stop by the center. A lot of them were mailed to our patrons in the mail. So you should have gotten it already. If not, it's coming, as well as accessible fully online as well. And we have a wealth of classes for if you want to write fiction or nonfiction, if you want to write your memoir, or if you want to write a book that's focused toward the teens and young people, whatever genre that you're looking for, you can find that kind of class at the Carnegie Center. And if for some reason we haven't covered it, let us know, because we are always looking for suggestions and ideas on what classes we can offer that will meet the needs of our writers' communities.
Dozens of languages are spoken in Fayette County schools. And that, of course, is a reflection of the cultural richness of Lexington's mm-hmm. international population.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm sure there's ongoing interest among new arrivals in English as a second language. But what about the other way around? Can English-only speakers expand their language capabilities at the Carnegie Center, learn other languages?
They definitely can. And that is actually how I first formed my relationship with the Carnegie Center. I took a Spanish class at the Carnegie Center years ago, and it was a phenomenal instructor, and I really enjoyed the class. And so we do offer many languages, and they fill up pretty quickly, especially French. They fill up pretty quickly, and so we have not only just the level one, we have levels 2, 3, 4, and 5, depending on the language, where learners can start out, you know, learning the language and continue to elevate in their growth and proficiency with that language. So French, Spanish, we definitely offer those classes. And if, as I said before, if there's a class, a foreign language you want to learn that we don't offer, let us know and we'll try to get that on the schedule as well.
And what is that like? What's it like to master another language?
Oh my gosh. Just speaking from personal experience, it's frustratingly fun. Because there are a lot of intricacies that are in other languages. For French example, as an example, that's the language I studied when I was in school, in high school and college, that we don't have in the English language. And so it's really a humbling experience. But when I studied, lived abroad and lived in France, it was just amazing, you know, to be able to communicate in another language. And I found, as I talked to my friends when I was over there, I found that you feel like you've really gotten close to mastery. I don't think I'll ever be a masterful French speaker. But when my dreams were starting to be in French, I was like, okay, I've been taught the right way. So,
you know, you're there when?
Yeah, when your dreams start, you start to dream in the foreign language as well. I think that you're really starting to really become proficient in it. So it's just a great experience. And no matter your age, it's never too late to learn a foreign language, even if you never had it in school, but you're curious or you've got an upcoming vacation planned with friends or family, take a class. I know there are many apps out there that will help you learn the language, but interacting with the instructor in class and your fellow students is a different experience and can be a very enjoyable one.
Sure. Lots of things going on at the Carnegie Center. We've been talking to Shayla Lynch. She is the executive director at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in Lexington. Thank you, Shayla.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
The work of Perryville native Melinda Jameson and her team at CASA of Lexington, CASA stands for Court Appointed Special Advocate, their work is often life-altering for children. CASA advocates are appointed by judges and trained to advocate for the best interests of abused and neglected children. They stay involved with each child until that child is placed in a safe, permanent home. For many of these children, the CASA advocate is the one constant adult presence in their lives. CASA Lexington, the state's largest CASA organization, services Fayette and six surrounding counties, Bourbon, Garrett, Jessamine, Lincoln, Scott, and Woodford. And now there's Oscar's Family, a children's picture book that tells the story. It was illustrated by Matthew Walden and written by Melinda Jameson, who joins us now. I'm glad to have you back on Eastern Standard, Melinda.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So tell us about Oscar's Family. What motivated this?
So the primary motivation was to give a tool to CASA volunteers when they may be matched to advocate for a child or a sibling group where the children are younger and have more than likely never heard of a CASA volunteer. Even as adults, many of us are unfamiliar with CASA. So this is one tool that a CASA volunteer can take when they're meeting a child or children for the first time to explain what their role is as a CASA volunteer.
Was this something that you felt was needed for a long time? I know you're a very busy person, so taking the time out to put together a book must have been quite a task. But was this something that you felt just a tool that was really needed?
Tom, you are correct. I had thought about doing this for several years, but you know how you have ideas and they get to the back burner because you're trying to keep all the balls in the air. And so in 2021, I decided that I was going to make the time to make it happen. So I sat down and wrote out the text for the book and then began working with illustrator Matthew Walden once we got the text where we wanted it to be. And then worked with him, and the book was published recently here in 2022.
Now, these are mostly fictional characters, but three of them, Oscar's teacher, Mrs. Best, his CASA volunteer, Liz, and her dog, Matilda, are all based on real people or persons, in the case of Matilda. So let's begin with Mrs. Best. Who is she?
So Gail Best taught kindergarten for 49 years at Perryville Elementary School, located in Boyle County, and I attended that school as a student from second grade through sixth grade at the time. My younger sister actually had Miss Best as a kindergartner teacher, and actually her four children have now had Miss Best. So I wanted to honor her service, considering she spent 49 years teaching kindergarten.
And tell us about Liz and Matilda. And I mentioned Matilda as a person. She's a dog, but we often refer to dogs around here as some of the finest individuals we've ever known. So, person. Tell us about them.
Absolutely. Liz Nofsinger is one of our CASA staff members. Her title is Volunteer Manager. And what the volunteer managers do is they guide the volunteers through the court system. They go with them on the first visit to meet the children, assist them in writing their court reports that go to the court, where they make recommendations to help the judge make a more informed decision. And Liz actually is also our CASA canine handler, which means she houses Matilda. Matilda may be the most well-known member of the CASA of Lexington team. She is a fully trained service dog. So she went through 2 years of training with Canine Companions for Independence, and then we were matched with her. And Matilda can work up to 20 hours a week, but her primary role is to provide a sense of comfort to the children that we work with. She is trained to downstay for up to 4 hours and won't make any noise or move. And so she can go into the box with the child if they need to testify in front of their perpetrator, which here in Kentucky, that is law. So these children often have to testify in front of a known perpetrator, which you can imagine can be incredibly taxing and anxiety-induced. And Matilda can put her head in their lap and just sit there for 4 hours. We can turn over her leash to them. She also goes on home visits to see children. If a child has to have a medical exam to substantiate sexual abuse, they can take her leash and she can go right into the exam room with them to provide that sense of comfort. She attends court and really, like I said, is a sense of comfort, not only for the children, but sometimes the families, other people in the courtroom, and even the judges.
It's quite a dog. Well, I'm wondering, Melinda, have you been noticing or watching any particular trends in family dysfunction that are related somehow to the pandemic that have come out of this period that we've been going through?
So we definitely have noticed that petitions, which are the alleged abuse or neglect that's occurring, have taken a decline, not only here in Fayette County and our other counties of service, but across the entire state. And part of that is the number one reporter has been educators. And we all know for a time we had schools closed and children weren't in the classroom, as well as medical visits. Many things were happening virtually. And if a child doesn't have a virtual connection, they're not being seen at all. And even when you have that virtual connection, you're not seeing the food child. So you may not notice bruising, or you may not be able to notice a behavior that where you indicate something must be going on, to be able to ask questions and further see what's going on. So with a significant decrease, what we also know is research shows that us in time of anxiety or stress, child abuse and child neglect numbers increase. So we know that this has been a challenging time and continues to be a challenging time for many. So the numbers should be increasing, but statewide we've seen them decrease. And Tom, that's very concerning, because what that means is there are children out there that don't have petitions that have been filed that really could be in need of services and are victims of abuse or neglect.
Mm. Well, I have to believe, Melinda, that it takes a very special person to step up and volunteer to do this work.
We do believe that and agree with you. You have to be at least 21 years of age. But in terms of special qualifications, you really just need a heart for children and wanting to make a difference. You don't need any degree or any background. We provide a 30-hour training where we give you a lot of information. And then you're supported by that staff person called a volunteer manager that guides you through the process, is there to ask questions. And they are limited by Kentucky Revised Statute to having 30 volunteers they supervise, which means that each volunteer gets adequate amount of time with that supervision and has time for questions or to have the volunteer manager attend a home visit with them. So if anybody happens to be listening, we'd love if you reach out if you have any interest. Our website is casaoflexington.org. And based on your location, you can also check with the Kentucky CASA Network for programs across the state. Right now, there are CASA programs in 80 of our 120 counties. And if someone is located where there's not a program, we'd be happy to work with them to get a program started.
Well, let's hope somebody out there is listening to us and thinking, you know what, I'd be really good at that. And we'll take you up on that that information. And what about Oscar's family? Where can we find the book?
So it is available on Amazon.com, which people tend to love. It's also available on our Casa of Lexington website in the Casa shop, and you can pick it up or we can ship it to you. And then some local bookstores have it. So there is Kentucky Soaps and Such in Stamford is carrying it, and the Plaid Elephant located in downtown Danville currently has the book.
And all proceeds go to Casa?
That is correct. 100% of the proceeds from the sale of the book go directly to Casa of Lexington. Both Matthew, the illustrator, and myself are not retaining any fees. And so 100% of that money goes right back into the work being done at Casa of Lexington.
All right. That's Melinda Jameson, Executive Director of Casa of Lexington. And we thank you so much, Melinda.
Thank you.
What does a county attorney do? That job description is the latest in our weekly series in partnership with Civic Lex and its director, Richard Young, to detail the offices that will appear on the November 8th ballot.
The county attorney is an office that exists in all 120 counties in Kentucky. The role was first made a constitutional office through the adoption of Kentucky's second constitution in 1850. The most recent constitution made the county attorney a required role with a four-year term. In 1976, Kentucky's General Assembly modified the office of the attorney general so that county attorneys are under their direction. The attorney general has the power to disqualify county attorneys from any court case and can also direct the county attorney to act as a special prosecutor for a court case. County attorneys are essentially the lawyer for the county. They prosecute cases on behalf of the county and represent it if it gets sued or otherwise needs defense. They also work with state and federal agencies on criminal investigations and other basic legal duties. It's important to note that they only prosecute and pursue cases within the jurisdiction of the district court or family court. Usually, these cases are things like DUIs, domestic violence cases, traffic violations, and child protection cases. They are also responsible for legal action against other county officials should they break the law. If taxes are collected unjustly, election laws are violated, or taxpayer money is used illegally, the county attorney can take legal action against all officials and employees involved. The only candidate on the ballot in 2022 for Fayette County Attorney is Angela Evans, who is an incumbent. Make sure to register to vote or check that your registration is up to date by October 11, 2022 to participate in the upcoming election. You can do that at govoteky.com. Want to learn more about the positions on the ballot in Fayette County? Head on over to lex.vote to learn more. Want more information on all things local government? You can check out our website at civiclex.org, subscribe to our Civic Lex weekly newsletter, and follow us on social media. From Civic Lex for Eastern Standard, I'm Richard Young.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at eswek.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.